This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Iran holds nationwide parliamentary elections tomorrow, but the key question is how many Iranians will turn out to vote. Weeks ago, a panel of hardline Islamic clerics disqualified thousands of reformist candidates. Hundreds of members of the current parliament resigned in protest and called for the Iranian people to boycott the election. But many Iranians had come to that conclusion even before this latest uproar, disillusioned with ineffectual reformers and with conservatives alike. 25 years after the Islamic Revolution, new questions are being asked about the nature and legitimacy of Iran's government, about how Iranians see their place in the region and the world, and it comes amid a new controversy about Iran's nuclear intentions. UN weapons inspectors said today they found undeclared high-tech equipment on an Iranian Air Force base. That's the first known link between Iran's supposedly civilian nuclear program and the military. Later in the program, we'll review the cases for and against Israel's security barrier. They'll be heard at the World Court next week. But first, Iran. If you have questions about tomorrow's elections, the limited powers of Iranian elected officials, or about the future of Iran, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now on the line from Tehran is Farnaz Fasihi, the Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. Thanks a lot.
What's the mood there in Tehran the night before the election begins?
It's definitely not the same as the election mood 4 years ago, where, you know, almost 80% of the eligible voters turned to the polls. It hardly seems like there's elections. Almost everyone I've spoken to says that they're not going to participate in the vote tomorrow. Student activists, intellectuals, even the Nobel Peace Prize winner Shirin Ebadi have called for a boycott of the elections.
Now, two liberal newspapers were closed down today. An office building owned by Iran's leading reformist party was sealed off. Is there a crackdown happening?
Absolutely. I think this may be just the beginning of a crackdown. The newspapers, everybody was anticipating, but people were predicting that it would probably be after the elections. It's interesting that they didn't even wait for tomorrow to pass and then do it next week. What comes as a surprise is the sealing off of the reformist campaign headquarters. Many of the reformers I've spoken to are concerned that there may be arrest warrants and they may actually be arrested in the following weeks.
Of course, if they're boycotting the elections, there can't have been a whole lot of activity underway in that campaign office.
No, there wasn't a whole lot of activity underway there at all. Pretty much about a week ago, when it became clear that they weren't going to be qualified and reinstalled as candidates, pretty much closed down there. So it's interesting. It's symbolic that they shut it down.
Now, there was, as we mentioned, a lot of disillusion when reformers who were elected last time were unable to enact the reforms that they'd promised to do because of, for a variety of reasons. But anyway, there was a relaxation on a lot of social issues. Is there fear that after elections tomorrow, where conservatives are expected to win now, is there fear that some of those relaxations are going to be challenged again?
I think that the social relaxation is not so much, because I think we're seeing a rise of pragmatic conservatives, conservatives who know that the only chance they have to hold on to power is to relax social moves and sort of distract the young population from being political. What people fear is that there will be relaxation of social strictures, and there will be this tendency for making friends with the West, as we have seen happening recently. But then more crackdown on democracy and on essential issues like human rights and civil rights. I think that's what most people are worried about, that these are the things that will be jeopardized.
Now, the reformist parties, in calling for a boycott of elections, they're not running. Where do they plan to focus their energies after the elections?
There's been much talk about forming an internal opposition group. I think that's where they're heading. I think the reformist parties are going to transform into a first-ever domestic opposition group that's stemmed from the system. And this itself is very remarkable because you have people who are from the system, people who still have very powerful friends, including the president, who will be still in office, who are basically challenging the very essence of the regime.
Now, given the disillusion with the reformers even before, as we mentioned, this showdown with the conservatives, is boycotting the elections a way to get some credibility back with the people who had ceased to support them?
Yes. I think that the people were watching very carefully to see whether this was just an internal discussion, an internal schism, or were they really going to stand hard against the conservatives. And they've gained a lot of respect and a lot of trust in the past month since their sit-in and since their resignation, and now that they've still, been very forcefully saying we're not going to participate. I think that a lot of people are starting to sort of turn to see whether that the reformers will in fact turn into a viable option.
And one interesting aspect of the closure of those two liberal newspapers was what they were closed down for. They published a rather extraordinary letter.
They did. The 130 reformist candidates who resigned from office wrote an open letter to the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, criticizing him and accusing him of leading a system that is undemocratic and that crushes human rights and civil rights and freedom. This is the first of its kind. It was handed out and circulated in the parliament during a press event, The judiciary asked all the newspapers and the media, the broadcasting media, not to publish this. It's a criminal offense to criticize the Supreme Leader. The only two media publications that carried it out were the two reformist newspapers and the reformist party's website, which were all shut down today.
Now, does that leave any reformist press still functioning? And is it going to be difficult to restart a reformist newspaper after this?
I think what's happened is this constant game of shutting one newspaper and the staff and the editors and the reporters going and getting reopening as another under another name. So the journalists here are a resilient bunch. So I'm sure that there will be another reformist newspaper. These were the two most vocal reformist papers. There are some other reformist-leaning papers still out there. Whether they're going to remain open or closed, we'll see.
And when these papers are closed, you said it was a criminal offense to publish these letters. Are people going to end up in jail as a result?
The editors have been called to court, so it's very possible.
Well,
fined heavily.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Farnaz Fasihi is the Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and she spoke to us on the phone from Tehran. And with us now from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Bangor is Bahman Bakhtiari, an Iranian-American and a professor of international relations at the University of Maine at Orono. He's also the author of Parliamentary Politics in Revolutionary Iran. He recently returned from a three-week visit to Iran, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you very much.
Is the picture that you just heard painted for us one that you saw when you were in Tehran last month?
Absolutely. I think what I noticed was really the apathy in Iran, and no matter what age or what class background you ask people about the elections, they were all uniformly saying that they're not going to participate in the coming elections. So it is not surprising to see such an apathy, and I think the whole scenario of preparing for the elections in the past several months has led people in Iran to come to the conclusion that elections are simply an instrument for a change of power among one group to another without any kind of clear objective of what it means for the people at large.
We've heard a lot of analysis here that the conservatives, because people were so disillusioned with the reformers they elected last time, because they were ineffectual, because of that, the conservatives were touted to win anyway, and yet went through the effort to ban all these reformist candidates and close down newspapers. Why?
Well, I think if observers of Iran would have noticed that almost a year ago, there were signals from the Council of Guardians that they will take harsh actions against those reformists who write those letters to the Supreme Leader repeatedly and criticize the whole operations of the system. And so they were on notice. And the amazing thing is that many people in Iran, listening to the proceedings of Iranian parliament, because it's broadcast live, similar to C-SPAN, they have the opportunity to hear what is happening in parliament. They were expecting this to happen. And it was surprising that the parliamentarians themselves were more surprised because of the rejections than the Iranians were. So they were placed in a situation that when the rejections came about, they started a parliamentary sit-in, and they faced total apathy because nobody came on the streets to defend them.
Now, is there any reliable way to gauge a public opinion in Iran? Are there good polls there?
Well, there's been several polling organizations in Iran, but unfortunately, similar to the papers, as soon as they have revealed the general discontent in society, they've been shut down. And two pollsters, as a matter of fact, are in jail because of the polling that they did regarding relations with U.S. So in a way, conservatives are sensitive to those poll results. And they do not want to have the environment change in such a way that gives them a bad image.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Mark, who's on the line with us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Thanks a lot, Neil. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure.
I just heard your current guest say that there's a certain amount of apathy. I thought that initial reports were that leaders had been sort of leading this trend to boycott the elections because of, you know, all of the disqualifications. And then I'm wondering, what is it that they really hope to accomplish by what I see is perhaps just removing their voices from the process rather than being able to maintain, you know, an effect on it from the inside?
Professor Bakhtiari?
Well, that was a crucial debate among the reformist faction in Iran because, as you know, the reformist group in Iran is divided into 17 or 18 groups, and part of them are taking part in the elections coming. The Speaker of the Parliament, who is the reformist, and several of the clerics from the Association of Combatant Clergy that Khatami also belongs, they decided not to boycott the elections, and they decided to participate because they thought that even having a voice of minority in the system is better than not being shut down. So the caller has a viewpoint that it is actually being considered by the reformists, but I think generally the public as a whole has given up on the reformists. Now, this is different to say the public has given up on the reform movement. So there's a distinction between the reform movement and the reformist. And the current players in Iran do not enjoy the confidence of the public anymore.
I see. So in other words, what you're saying is that, and I heard this alluded to with your previous guest, was that they are talking about creating a new organization, not necessarily even with those individuals who are currently in power, but finding new people to sort of take the place of those individuals because those previous people who had been elected were not effective.
I think what Farnaz Fasihi was talking about was a channeling their efforts in kind of a new direction. Do you agree with that, Professor Bakhtiari?
Yes, there is a group of actually very within the reformist movement, the brother of the president, another MP named Elahi Kulayi, and others who have now openly calling for a different form of political organization in Iran, one that operates outside the system and tries to engage in something of a civil disobedience. This could be an important transition in Iranian politics if it happens, but again, it is conditional on the engagement of the Iranian population. So if Iranian population remains apathetic and kind of indifferent toward it and still views these people as part of the system, no matter what organization they form, it's not going to be successful.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll have more when we come back from a break. We're discussing Iran this hour. Our guest is Bahman Bakhtiari at the University of Maine at Orono. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We are talking about Iran, which is holding controversial parliamentary elections tomorrow. Many, maybe most Iranians are expected to boycott it. If you have a question about the process or if you're an Iranian living here and are concerned about events taking place in your home country, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Bahman Bakhtiari, a professor of international relations at the University of Maine at Orono. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ali, who joins us from Northern California.
Hi, first-time caller. I believe that the Iranian people in general are fed up with both the conservatives and the reformists. I can tell you this because I went home for two family weddings last January in 2003, and I had a chance to talk to a lot of family members. I think Iranian people in general are trying to survive. About 75% of the people are below poverty line, and they are doing their best to outlast the regime. And there are severe economic and social problems in Iran, and their immediate issue is not the election tomorrow, but to be able to survive this the condition that they're living in. And if I may make more observations about my trip, for example, one of the problems that I noticed myself during the wedding that I attended, the father of the groom was very concerned about the loud music during the wedding ceremony, and he had about 10 million rials in his pocket to bribe the Revolutionary Guard in case they showed up. And just to give you an idea, the exchange rate between dollar and rial is about 8,200 to 1. It's not a lot of money in dollar value, but he was ready. He was very concerned, and they actually showed up, but there was not any problem, and they just wanted some food, and they went away. So these are the issues that Iranian people are dealing with. And
but you were taking that as a measure of the influence that the fear of the Revolutionary Guards has on everyday life.
The type of Revolutionary Guards that showed up were not the harmful ones. They were not hardcore believers in the regime. They just wanted some quality food and mm-hmm. got some, and they went away. But I'm just telling you, the concern of the people, especially the father of the groom, at that moment was to be able to have a successful wedding ceremony for his son. And I got a chance, because I attended two weddings, to talk to a lot of family members whom I hadn't seen for more than 25 years since I have lived in California since 1976. And what I'm saying right now is probably not gospel, but it's probably a smaller snapshot of the society. And none of the issues that we are discussing today, especially on your program, like if they are going to attend or if they are going to vote tomorrow, came up.
Hmm.
And they were basically concerned about their livelihood more than anything else.
Well, Bahman Bakhtiari, given what Ali has been telling us about economic failures, and obviously we have also been talking about the legislative frustrations of the reformers, is there anybody that you can tell us about recognized parties in Iran at this point that do have a lot of credibility with the Iranian people?
Well, I think the caller probably is reflecting some of the general viewpoints among the population, but is also part of a bigger picture is the growing depoliticization of Iranian society. And as a caller alluded to, concerns with everyday problems and concerns with education and other matters has allowed people to talk less about politics. And in many gatherings that when you go to, inevitably the topic is not politics. And it is much more of an interest to outsiders today. Iranian politics, I always find out that from outside is much more fascinating, and from inside Iran is much boring subject. So it is an allusion to the fact that we have a sense of alienation in Iran, both among the young and the old, that too much politics has not been beneficial. So in the long term, my own take on it is that less political engagement probably has a much more mature engage politics later on in the future. Now, there are no groups in Iran that Iranian population as a whole identified with. There are certain trends, political trends, that some sector of the population I identify with, and I think the trend of religious nationalism in Iran is a popular trend. They're a trend that talks about integrating nationalistic principles and ideas with some form of religion and spirituality. That is growing in Iran. There is a growth of mystical and mysticism in Iran. Religious spirituality is growing separate from politics. So there are trends that may indicate a greater secularization coming in Iran in the future.
Ali, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you for taking it.
Okay. News from Iran today is about the nuclear weapons program, or what appears to be a nuclear weapons program. UN inspectors discovered an advanced gas centrifuge system at an Air Force base outside the capital city of Tehran. Such equipment is used to enrich uranium, which can then be used for nuclear fuels or for nuclear warheads. Iran's nuclear weapons capabilities have long been a concern to the United States and the international community. Last year, Iran said it would suspend all uranium enrichment activities and permit unrestricted inspections of its nuclear facilities by the UN agency, the IAEA. Today's discovery of high-tech enrichment equipment at an undeclared site is the first known link between Tehran's supposedly civilian nuclear power program and the military. Joining us to talk about what today's news means is George Perkovich, Vice President of Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's written widely on the topic of nuclear nonproliferation. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
What does this discovery of this particular gas centrifuge system imply?
Well, it tells us a couple of things. One is that the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors are doing a good job. They're uncovering things that we hadn't known about previously. The second thing is there appears to be gains being made from Libya. In other words, Libya announced it would give up nuclear weapons. We sent inspectors there. We uncovered this network in Pakistan. And it seems like the leads that have led the inspectors now in Iran to these centrifuges are coming from Libya and Pakistan. So there's kind of a noose tightening. Finally, what it tells us about Iran is they deserve no benefit of the doubt. That for years, and including the last few months, Iran's been saying, look, we'll come clean, we'll be transparent, this entire effort is for peaceful purposes. And then every month, it seems, they get caught in non-full disclosure and say, oh, well, that, we didn't remember we had that, or we don't know where we got that.
And has there been any comment today about where this P2 gas centrifuge system came from?
Well, it's a little bit muddled so far. There's a reiteration from Iran that everything they're doing is for peaceful purposes, so it's not military. Then there seems to be a semantic denial that it's not a G2 centrifuge or a P2 centrifuge. You're kind of splitting hairs on that. But I don't think they know what their story is at the moment.
Now, this has been the agreement that Iran made with the IAEA was initially the result of negotiations with the European Union. And it was, some have called it sort of a good cop, bad cop, with the United States lurking in the background.
That's right. What happened in the fall, again, Iran got caught in a series of basically of lies. It was violating parts of its agreement on nonproliferation, got caught, was a lot of pressure, and then made a deal with foreign ministers from the EU saying, in essence, okay, we'll stop. We'll freeze uranium enrichment, and then we'll do some other things to come clean. What's happened subsequently is there's increasing evidence that they haven't come clean. They promised as part of that deal they would explain everything they had done in the past and they would reveal everything they had in mind. This latest evidence today suggests they haven't done that. There are other problems, though. The suspension that they promised has never been defined in kind of contractual terms. So they say, well, yeah, we said we suspend, but that's not suspension. And then the EU or the United States says, no, 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 you have to do more. And so we're disputing what they have committed to, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, if at all, do you think that this... let me put this another way. Is Iran's nuclear program, either whether they're portraying it as a civilian program or whether people there believe it's for nuclear weapons or not, but is it a nationalist issue in Iran? Is this something that is important internally and playing into the elections tomorrow?
I don't know that it'll play into the elections tomorrow, but certainly it's a big political issue. It has become more so to the extent that there's been international pressure. It's made it more of a nationalist political issue in Iran, and it cuts several ways. In other words, if the conservatives were to make a deal with outside powers and accede to pressure, would the progressives say, ah, you guys are weak and are caving in, and do that for opportunistic political reasons? That's kind of been the reaction the last few months, so it's very unpredictable how this plays in politics.
Baban Bakhtiari, I wanted to get your response on that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is definitely a nationalist issue, but the greater perception inside Iran is the fact that they're not looking at the nuclear issue so much as they're looking at the actors who are talking about the nuclear issue. And I think the clerics themselves at times play down the nationalist card, but on the nuclear issue they've been playing up the nationalist cards. And I think the overall perception among the population is that a nuclear peaceful Iran is definitely a national issue, but not under a clerical regime, maybe under a much more secular regime. So there's a kind of a refined boundary between the two, and the religious leadership has tried to capitalize on it, but I don't think it has been that successful, because within Iran the domestic issues are so overpowering that every time they try to mobilize on this issue, there are other issues that come up and they have to push it to the background.
George Perkovich, what's been the Bush administration's response?
Well, the Bush administration can't really make up its mind, it seems. There's a faction in the administration that says we shouldn't deal with Iran at all, really. We should seek regime change. We should put enough pressure on them that the government collapses. There's another group that says, look, the nuclear weapon issue is so serious and so germane to U.S. national interests, we can't wait. Regime change may take a long time. They could get nuclear weapons in 2 years. Therefore, whoever's in power in Iran, we have to deal with to change their behavior, to get them out of the nuclear weapon business. The president hasn't weighed in and kind of picked which side he's on in that dispute, so we've got a paralyzed non-policy, really.
So sort of a subdued reaction today to this discovery as opposed to the aha that you might have expected.
Right, and partly because, as I say, they haven't made up their mind what strategy they really want to pursue.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Todd, and Todd's with us from Reno, Nevada.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
Very well.
I love international history and politics, and I have my own personal fascination with it, but as an American in general, especially with our upcoming election, I'm not exactly sure why I should be paying attention to the Iranian election, especially in regards to the nuclear concerns. I don't know where each party stands.
Is this what we in the States would call a partisan issue, Baman Bakhtiari?
In the United States you're talking about?
No, in Iran. Do the reformers have a different position than the conservatives?
The reformers' position on the nuclear issue is not that different than the conservatives, but they feel that Iran should be much more open and transparent in its nuclear policy. And as George mentioned, I think the conservatives pursue a secret diplomacy vis-a-vis this issue and do not let the reformists in it. So there is a distinction between the viewpoints of the two, and the reformists do believe in an open, complete transparent nuclear policy, which the conservatives who control it do not find it feasible.
George?
To the caller's question, one reason why the election in Iran matters is if, as is likely, the conservatives gain power and the elections are perceived as having been unfair, that will actually ease the way for the international community to put more pressure on Iran. Now, I don't know what the result of that pressure would be, but one of the reasons that the EU, for example, wanted to pursue diplomacy was they said, well, we've got the reformers we can work with. There's Khatami, there's
a good
part of
it. You want to encourage the process.
We want to encourage the process with the reformers. They're telling us, you know, don't impose sanctions, don't threaten us. These guys we can work with. Well, if they're all out, and if the electoral process was rigged, it gets much more difficult to say, you know, these are people we really can work with. There's going to be a greater tendency to say, not only have they been lying on nuclear weapons, but they've been rigging elections. These are kinds of people that you actually pressure.
George Perkovich, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
George Perkovich is Vice President of Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Todd, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And we want to move to talk now about Iran's relationship with neighboring states. How do countries in the Middle East view the political situation in Iran and its relations with the international community? And joining us now with the conversation is Samer Shahata, Assistant Professor of Politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Nice of you. Thanks.
What's the view of Iran today from its neighbors? And since there are quite a few of them, let's start with the Arab countries like Jordan, Syria, and your home country of Egypt.
Well, I think the political classes in those countries certainly follow with great interest what's going on in Iran, and sometimes with some degree of jealousy, because as is going on, there are elections in Iran and there's political contestation, a great deal of it, actually more so than in all of the Arab world. But of course, countries like Egypt have a different strategic and military relationship vis-a-vis Iran, because Egypt doesn't share a border with Iran. Mm-hmm. The Gulf countries, of course, have had at different times very tense relationships with Iran. And of course, all of the Arab world during the 8-year Iraq-Iran war sided with Iraq. There has been, however, throughout the 1990s, a rapprochement, really, with the Arab world. And I think this has picked up especially under President Khatami, and we've seen a number of Arab presidents actually visit Tehran. And of course, the Iraq war most recently has brought the question of regional security to the forefront, and there have been a whole series of meetings between foreign ministers of different states, including Iraq and the other Arab states, and Turkey, of course, about Iraq's future, security issues, the U.S. in the region, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back 25 years to the Iranian Revolution, after that, all of the Gulf countries that you want to think about, Kuwait, the Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, all of them have sizable Shia population, certainly Iraq as well, a Shia majority there, and in other some of the other Gulf states as well. There was, at the time of the Iran-Iraq War, a big fear of Iranian-style fundamentalism sweeping through the Shia population of the region. Is that a spent force now?
I think many people in the Arab world feel that it's a spent force. Of course, at the time, after the revolution, Khomeini was trying to export his version of political Islam, and this was seen to be incredibly destabilizing in Iraq and in the rest of the Arab Gulf countries that you mentioned. In fact, that was one of the reasons or justifications that Saddam Hussein gave for invading Iran in 1980. But Iran's relationship with the Arab world, as the revolutionary intent of its foreign policy has diminished, has gotten better. And I don't think that there are countries now that are fearful of Iran's potential hegemony in the way that it was after the revolution.
And there is also an example of Iran which has not been a wild economic or political success.
No, and that's actually quite a big lesson for those of us who are interested in political Islam, as it were, and the lasting power of political Islam as a political force in the Middle East.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation about Iran, and then we'll preview next week's hearings at the International Court of Justice on the legality of the security barrier in Israel and the West Bank. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's wrap up our conversation about Iran with our guest, Samer Shahata, an assistant professor of politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University, and also still with us is Baman Bakhtiari, professor of international relations at the University of Maine at Orono. And Professor Bakhtiari, we were talking just before the break about the one-time revolutionary fervor in Iran. At this point, how does Iran see it itself in the region? Does it see itself as the revolutionary force it was 25 years ago, or as another country?
Well, I think most Iranians have turned completely inward, and part of the flexibility that has been allowed to the regime to make those policies that Samir mentioned regarding Egypt and other countries in the region is that the public has completely turned inward and are much more interested with domestic developments. Now, obviously, they're very concerned about Iraq, and Iraq is a very important country in Iran because of the religious relationship, pilgrimage, and the whole holy sites of Shia in Iraq for Iranians. But regarding Egypt and other countries, the lack of public involvement actually has led has allowed the regime to have a much more open hand in developing those relationships.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Joe, who's with us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, I have a question for your two guests. It seemed to me that Iran was moving fairly well along the road towards reform, and the reformist movement seemed to be gaining power until Bush made his Axis of Evil speech, and thus obviously including Iran as part of this alleged Axis of Evil. And then it seemed that the reformists started losing power, and the conservatives or the clerics started cracking down and reasserting their power. Do you think that this caused this inclusion in the Axis of Evil sort of, here's what happens if you try to reform, the America slaps you down?
Yeah, Baman Bakhtiari, is it cause and effect?
Well, I think it had a short-term effect. This is my personal viewpoint, that I believe that the harsh policies of George Bush strengthened the reformists to a certain extent, because the reformists were an important backbone to the conservatives as far as legitimacy was concerned for the regime. And by allowing the reformists to have a voice and by allowing them to become active, they could show a greater, stronger popular support for the regime. So the Axis of Evil actually had no political impact, but it may have rearranged the relationship between the factions in Iran to emphasize one faction like reformists vis-a-vis U.S. on the short term. On the whole, I think it had a negative impact among the public in Iran, because by calling Iran as part of the Axis of Evil, it was translated in a very negative connotations. So it did not help as far as the image of the United States was concerned, but it did kind of rearrange the factional politics in Iran.
Samer Shahata, thanks very much for the call, Joe, by the way. Samer Shahata, Iran claimed leadership amongst the Shiites of Islam, a minority sect in Islam, but still very, very important in the Middle East especially. Is the possibility of a Shia-dominated government in Iraq going to be perceived as a new power node for Shias throughout the Middle East?
Well, I think that certain states are very much afraid of that. Saudi Arabia, for example, that has a Shia population of approximately 15%, which sees itself as being disenfranchised, and Bahrain also. But Ali al-Sistani, for example, the Shia cleric in Najaf, has really made a point to go out of his way and say that we do not envision the same kind of a role in politics as occurred in Iran after the Iranian Revolution. That is a direct clerical role of power, the idea of the Velayat al-Faqih. So I don't think that even if the Shia in Iraq come to play their fair part in Iraqi politics, we're likely to see anything like a kind of revolutionary, radical interpretation of Islam and politics that we saw in Iran after 79.
And Baman Bakhtiari, would the clerics in Iran, the people who do rule that country, would they see a Shia leadership in Iraq, or a Shia participating in a democratic system in Iraq, would they see that as a challenge to their power?
I agree with Samir that the Iranian clerics do not see their increasing power of the Shiites in Iraq, even though Ali Sistani is very much a traditionalist and non-political person, mm-hmm. completely different than Ayatollah Khomeini, as a challenge. And but I think overall, Najaf and Karbala are important areas of Shia learning in
those
Iraq.
Cities are both in Iraq, yes.
In Iraq, and also there are several Iraqi clerics in Iran today who were born in Iraq, but are in power in Iran. For example, the head of the judiciary is of Iraqi background, and several important advisors to the supreme leaders are of Iraqi background. So there is a lot more complexities in terms of relationship with Iraq than it seems, and I do not think Iranian regime will be threatened at all by any form of democratic change in Iraq, because they think of this having increased the power of Shiites in Iraq, which they want to do anyway.
Baman Bakhtiari, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Baman Bakhtiari, a professor of international relations at the University of Maine at Orono. His book is Parliamentary Politics in Revolutionary Iran, and he was with us from the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Bangor. And Samer Shahata, always good to speak with you.
Thank you.
Assistant professor of politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. He was with us here in Studio 3A.